Welcome to Parshas Beha'alosecha.
Parshas Beha'alosecha is like, reminds me of a bright sunny day with not a cloud in the sky, and about midday, suddenly the sky gets filled with dark rain clouds, and in a matter of minutes, we're experiencing torrential downpours. If you look at the topics in Beha'alosecha, it starts off very upbeat and uplifting. We start off with the menorah, which is a special mitzvah for the Kohanim, for the priests, a daily mitzvah to light the menorah. We go on to the consecration of the Levites and their special jobs in the tabernacle. We then go on to describe the Pesach offering on the second year. The first would be the first commemorative Pesach, so to speak, after the real Exodus. Then a group of Jews came to Moshe and they said, "We have a problem. We were unfit to bring the Pesach offering because we had been at a funeral and we had come in contact with the dead, and we are impure. We cannot bring the offering. What are we going to do? We don't want to miss out on the opportunity." And that's a rabbi's dream. You know, "Rabbi, I couldn't make it to shul. What can I do? What can I make? When can I make it up? You know, can I come one night during the week?" And that would be a... So, and then Moshe said, "Let me ask Hashem," and Hashem actually gave a mitzvah called Pesach Sheni. A second chance. A second chance. If you miss the first date, which is the 14th of Nisan, because you were unable to make it to the temple, or you were impure, you can bring it on the 14th day of Iyar. Unprecedented in the entire Torah. A makeup date. That's very uplifting, because that was something that came from the people with a great desire to bring Karbanot. And then we read about the divine, miraculous signs of the Israelites' travels, which consisted of a cloud, which when they were ready to move, the cloud would start moving and they would follow it. At night it was a pillar of fire, a tangible sign that God's presence was among them always. How uplifting it was. And then the mitzvah of trumpets. Hashem told Moshe to fashion silver trumpets, and these trumpets would be used at all special occasions, when there was an assembly, when it was time to travel, when they were being threatened by an enemy and they needed to rally the people and inspire the people that God would fight for them. Days of festivals and new moons. The trumpets, you can just hear the majesty of these silver trumpets being blown in the Jewish camp. The trumpets are not in use now. In the temple, they used to actually, on Rosh Hashanah, they used to have the shofar blown with side accompaniment from the trumpets. And the trumpets would sound, and then the trumpets would fade, and the shofar would continue. That's how it's described in the Mishnah. But it's just a majestic scene. And then it was told that it was time to move. First time they would leave, they would break up camp after they had settled around Mount Sinai for some close to a year, because this is they got there at the month of Sivan, right before Shavuos, and this is the month of Iyar, which is 11 months around the year, and they're picking up. And where are they going? They're going straight into the land of Israel. I mean, it's just so uplifting, the entire parsha. And a little sidebar, that Moshe speaks to his father-in-law Yisro, who had been with them since the time of the giving of the Torah, and he says, "Please come with us. We want you to come with us into the land." And Yisro declined. He said, "I must go back to my people." But it appears that Yisro went in order to be makarev them, to reach out to them and to encourage them to come and live in Israel. And sure enough, we read about the descendants of Yisro coming to the land of Israel and settling there. Yes, he converted. He converted.
I said, were they all descendants, or were some of them just people who lived in that city?
I think they were descendants. I don't think he got... I think it was mainly his family members. He may have had a large family. He was like the patriarch. And then we have the victory march when they started to journey. The famous words that we say in the when we take out the Torah. Vayihi bin so'ahoron vayomer Moshe Kuma Hashem viyavutzu oyevecha veyanusu misanecha miponecha. In the next verse, when we put the Torah back, uvnucho yomar shuvo Hashem rivavos alfei Yisrael. Arise, Hashem, and let your foes be scattered. Let those who hate you flee from before you. And when it rested, he would say, reside tranquilly, O Hashem, among the myriad thousands of Israel. This is, you know, just a high point. So, all these things reminds me of a bright, sunny day. But, out of nowhere, chapter 11, sounds like somebody filed for bankruptcy. Out of nowhere, the people took to seeking complaints. It was evil in the ears of Hashem, and Hashem heard, and his wrath flared, and a fire of Hashem burned against them, and it consumed at the edge of the camp. The people cried out to Moses. Moses prayed to Hashem, and the fire died down. He named that place Tavera, for the fire of Hashem had burned against them. Next episode. The rabble that was among them cultivated a craving, and the children of Israel also wept once more and said, who will feed us meat? We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt, free of charge, the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now our life is parched. There is nothing. We have nothing to anticipate but the manna. Moses heard the people weeping in their family groups, each one at the entrance of his tent, and the wrath of Hashem flared greatly, and in the eyes of Moshe was bad. Something happened here. What was the little title on our email this week? What went wrong? Where did these storm clouds come from? Out of nowhere. And it goes from bad to worse. The next thing is Moshe turning to Hashem, complaining, why have you done evil to your servant? Why have I not found favor in your eyes that you placed the burden of this entire people upon me? Did I conceive this entire people? Did I give birth to it? That you say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a suckling? Where shall I get meat to give these entire people? I cannot carry this entire nation, for it is too heavy for me. Moshe Rabbeinu, the fearless leader who has taken them for over a year's time through thick and thin, doing miracles. And Hashem responds to Moshe and says, yes, you do need some helpers. We're going to appoint a Sanhedrin, a court of 70 elders. We're going to help you bear the burden. Why didn't Moshe ask for this before? Why all of a sudden? What happened here? What went wrong?
He did it just so.
What?
Jethro told him to get helpers. Let's get judges. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think, that's a good question. I think that the initial judges that he had appointed
were killed.
In fact, those were the ones that were consumed by the fire.
But the golden calf and all.
Well, there's also elders here. Oh, okay.
The golden calf, they killed all the elders because they didn't want to sacrifice. They wouldn't you know, they weren't going to make the golden calf.
You mean the people killed them?
Yeah.
Okay. So this was another group. But Moshe never complained this way. And it's worse. It gets worse. Miriam and Aaron, chapter 12, spoke against Moshe, against Lashon Hara, regarding the Cushite woman he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. Hashem heard this and was very disturbed that anyone would speak against Moshe. And so he punished Miriam. She became Metzoras, leprous, which is the spiritual plague that strikes primarily for sins of Lashon Hara. Yeah, Moshe. Well, Moshe's wife was from Midian. What they were saying was, they weren't making fun of her, Zipporah. What they were saying was that Moshe, at some point, had separated from his wife, and he said, "I am a prophet, and I need to be on constant call for prophecy." And a prophet must be in the state of purity at all times. And as such, it would not befit him to be married. And so he separated from Zipporah. Aaron and Miriam, their comment was, what they said was it only to Moses that Hashem spoke? Did he not speak to us as well? As if to say, we're prophets, and we're married. And what was disturbing about this was that Hashem said, you're comparing yourselves to Moshe. You are really not on the same level of prophecy as Moshe is. And he lets them know. He said, hear my words, if there shall be prophets among you, in a vision shall I, Hashem, make myself known to him. In a dream shall I speak with him. I will communicate with my prophets in a vision or dream. Not so is my servant Moshe. In my entire house, he is the trusted one. Mouth to mouth do I speak to him, in a clear vision, not in riddles. At the image of Hashem does he gaze. Why did you not fear to speak against my servant Moshe? The wrath of Hashem flared up against them, and he left.
Was Moshe the only prophet throughout Jewish history to whom Hashem spoke directly?
Yes. That is testified at the end of the Torah. The very last page about the uniqueness of Moshe and his prophecy. Never again has there arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom Hashem had known face to face. The third verse from the end of the Torah. And if you ever read the Yigdal, which is a little poem that's sung at the end of Davening Friday night, there is something about this. Lo kam b'Yisrael kemoshe od navi umabit estemunaso. It literally says, you know, never did a prophet rise up like Moshe, never will there be, who looks at God's image. He was unique.
Did Hashem ask Moshe to separate from Zipporah?
I'm not sure.
Was that Moshe's
inclination? I think it was a practical thing. Moshe could receive prophecy at any time, and he wouldn't be able to if he was, if he had a relations with his wife without immersing, and therefore it was. I mean, I think he did what he had to do, and they mistook his level of prophecy with their own. They didn't have often prophecies, and if they did, they probably got an email, you know, that was going to happen next week. You know, it was an appointment. Whereas Moshe, it could happen at any time. And so they could not, they were wrong in comparing themselves to him. But getting back to our point here, it seems that everything was going great. Hunky-dory. at least since Yom Kippur, you know, there was an incident with the golden calf. But since Yom Kippur, we're talking about from Yom Kippur till Iyar, it's at least 6 or 7 months, things have been just beautiful, smooth sailing. And all of a sudden, things start deteriorating. The people have a problem. They take to complaints. They take to craving meat. I mean, at a time like this, why is that on their mind? Suddenly the man is not good enough. Then Moshe Rabbeinu has a problem with his responsibility. Miriam and Aaron have a problem with Moshe. It seems like everything is just falling apart. And where did it come from? What triggered it? And it's not just these few incidences. Do you know that starting with Beha'alosecha, almost till the end of the book, we are dealing with major, major breakdowns in the Jewish people. Next week, Shalach, the incident with the spies, that led to the decree that the Jewish people would not enter the land, and they would wander in the desert for 40 years, until they all died. Only the young generation would go in. Korach, the next parsha, the uprising, where Korach, a cousin of Moshe, got very distinguished leaders to stage an uprising against Moshe's authority. And the next one, Chukas, Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron, the famous sin, you know, which we barely see the sin, but they hit the rock, and from that it was decreed that neither of them would enter the land. And Balak, the Jewish people, are nearly cursed by the prophet Bilam. It just seems to go from bad to worst, and it just came out of nowhere. So, you know, this parsha literally reminds me of a beautiful sunny day, and in no time it starts to pour, and I'm just baffled. Where did it come from? And clearly we know that we are not free of stumbling and challenges, and we know we can have ups and we know we can have downs, both personally and collectively. But we'd like to see if there's any indication in the Torah that tells us what triggered this decline. And, you know, it's good to know for ourselves so that we can be prepared, so that we can be forewarned. So let's see what clues there are. So let's look back where it started. Chapter 11. Bankruptcy. Chapter 11. The people took to seeking complaints. Ra b'oznei Hashem. It was evil in the ears of Hashem. In the ears of Hashem it was evil. One of the commentators says that nobody else could hear it. They weren't complaining. They weren't standing around and complaining out loud. The word is kimis onanim, like complainers. Only Hashem could hear it, because it was something inside of them. It was a tiny attitude that was starting to develop, and only Hashem could perceive it. Maybe they didn't even realize it themselves. But there's more. We have a midrash which tells us an amazing thing, that this fire that broke out after the complainers and consumed at the edge of the camp, this fire had consumed the leaders. And the midrash tells us that these leaders were the same leaders that had been guilty way back in Shemos of gazing upon the image of God at the time of the giving of the Torah in a way which was inappropriate. They were eating and drinking, and they were becoming a little bit too casual in the presence of the Divine Spirit. in the presence of the Shekhinah. And God at that point did not really want to disturb the festivities of the giving of the Torah, and so he withheld judgment. But this, what happened over here, when there was a little bit of complaining, so all of a sudden, it was the day of reckoning for both. For both the irreverence that was shown at the time of the giving of the Torah, as well as the complaining over here. There seems to have been something building up from before. Well, yeah, I'm not exactly sure how this fits in with what you told me. It sounds like these were the original 70.
The original 70 died early.
Right, so I don't know. I don't know if maybe it's just different opinions. Or maybe there were three sets. I'm not sure how to work that out. But there's something else. I mean, these are the clues that we have. There's nothing that's really outright. In fact, it doesn't say what they were complaining about. Later on, there was the rabble that was complaining about the food. But the first mention of the complainers, it doesn't identify what it was. Ramban says that it was because they were started to travel, and all of a sudden they were being brought into the unknown, and they didn't know where they were going or how long the journey would be, and it was the desert, and so for they were complaining about just being in the wilderness. But whatever it is, and some say they were just seeking complaints. They didn't really have a big problem. They just needed something to complain about. Why would they be looking for complaints? All of this is really just baffling. And let me tell you one other thing. The Talmud says that really the trouble happened earlier, a verse or two before, and you don't even notice there's a problem. It says, Vayisu mehar Hashem, derech shloshes yamim. They journeyed from the mountain of Hashem a three-day distance. The Talmud says that was tragedy. That was tragic that they journeyed from the mountain of Hashem. Why is that tragic? They were told the cloud lifted and started to move, and they followed it. They were supposed to travel. What was the tragedy? Says the Talmud, the tragedy was that they had been standing around Mount Sinai for all of these months. And when it was time to leave, they packed up and they got out of there eagerly. The Talmud compares it to children who, when school is over, they just slam shut their books and run for the door. I was talking to some of the kids in camp about this story, and I said, let's say that you were in school and the teacher was teaching, and he was in the middle of a verse, and the bell rang, right? So what would we do? Close the chumash and run out? You know, they're entitled, period's over. But students who were truly interested and, you know, listen to every word, yeah, imagine that, would say, we don't want to leave in the middle of a pasuk. Let's finish. We'll come late to recess or to dismissal.
Is this an experience?
Well, I told the boys about this, and afterwards, got them into this. I said, let's see what happens. Which way you're going to respond? So I finished and I said, okay, it's time for recess, and they just sat there. And they said, we want you to finish the Devar Torah. Anyway, but the Talmud says that the tragedy was that they ran a little too eagerly, more interested in getting away from Mount Sinai than staying there. Mount Sinai was where they had received all the commandments, and the Talmud says they were eager to leave because they were afraid maybe there'll be more.
Actually, they were afraid all along.
Yeah, they didn't even initially. They had to be forced into it.
But they only actually took God to rescuing from Moses.
Yeah.
Or through Moses, however you. Yeah, through Moses would be more accurate.
Right.
Can you just tell me what your thoughts are where it says that, that the Moshe heard them talking, each one at the entrance to their home, you know, something like that.
Rashi quotes the Midrash and says that they were complaining about the domestic laws, that they were told that there are certain forbidden marriages, that before that hadn't been so, and they were in contempt over that. So the food wasn't good, the marriage laws weren't good. They resented the discomfort of having to wander, even though God was planning to bring them into Israel in a matter of days, and it turned into 40 years, just because they became complainers. So what's happening here? What's this phenomenon that seems very, very subtle, maybe an attitude, but it's leading to much greater breakdowns, which are, you know, are just unimaginable in their repercussions. I mean, you know, if you consider this to be the beginning of a downward spiral, which includes the spies, you're talking about, you know, the sins, the magnitude of which the temple is destroyed. I mean, this idea of the spies coming back and reporting and the people crying. This was the night that was decreed to be Tisha B'Av, which was when both temples were destroyed. And it all seems to start sliding right here, seeking complaints. It all seems to start even before when they left Mount Sinai. It all seems to have its root there. It doesn't seem to be that terrible. Why does this lead to such grave things?
Was it the pretext because they're complaining about the lack of meat?
Yeah, do you think it was really just food,
no,
or was that a pretext?
No, it was a pretext.
Right. So what's underlying, what's bothering them? Yeah. What's at the root of it?
They're losing their freedom. They were free to do whatever. I mean, everything is relative. They're in slaves in Egypt. Now they're there for a year. But now Hashem is directing them. This is what you have to do in your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
They rebelled.
Still doesn't really make good sense to me, because I mean, they're already used to being enslaved, and now what demands, if you want to call it that, that Shem's making, it seems to me it's not even anything compared to what they were having put on the Egypt.
Although we find that they wanted to go back, some of them said, well, let's go back to Egypt. A few times throughout the Torah that you hear that. We wish we would have stayed in Egypt. One time they said, were there not enough graves in Egypt? He had to take us here to die in the desert?
Maybe they should have gone back.
We can only answer in terms that we can relate
to. Mm-hmm.
But I was just thinking, you know, you don't make a rabbi by taking him out of cheder and make a rabbi. You know, you have to go through a lot of steps.
Mm-hmm.
And then understanding, same thing in medical school or anything like that, in graduate school, you have to take steps. Seems to me they were brought along too fast. I can understand how they just went from one thing to another. They didn't have a training period. Everything that I know, you know, in this world requires lots of training. And it's not just, you've got to learn it, live it, practice it, and then you get elevated, you learn more lessons.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were over their head.
So, I mean, are you saying that Hashem misjudged? I mean, what are you saying?
Well,
I mean,
well, I don't know. Hashem, you know, knows what he's doing, but maybe he planned it for it to happen this way. I don't know, so I can't fault Hashem. But and based on the way we know things,
right,
they were over their head. There's no way. I don't see how we could expect them to do all the things. I mean, this thing about how much can you take? You know, it's just like the first time you fast. You know, you have a kid, you know, you let them fast for a few hours and
right,
to throw them in there and expect all that. So that's
mm-hmm,
that's just
okay,
the way I see it.
I can see the
mm-hmm
feeling that they have the slave mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Here they're in Egypt for hundreds of years and they have no freedoms. Now they have no freedoms again. Or Hashem is giving them structure, but to them they may perceive it as, again, we're
having... Here we go again.
That's right, we have more freedom. And rebellion begins.
Hmm. But certainly they've been through a lot already. They've experienced a lot. They've seen miracles. They've seen they've seen how God is on their side. They've seen themselves winning wars and beating mighty nations.
Rabbi, it's like,
too easy.
It's like a politician, Rabbi.
What have you done for me lately?
What have you done for me this hour?
Yeah.
It still seems a little difficult to understand, like they're talking about all the...
Well, like Jack said, these are not real problem complaints. These are they're made up complaints, so that they complain, so they can complain, seeking complaints. But if I could just, based on you know what I've read, and I don't have a clear source for what I'm saying, but it seems to me that this was, again, putting it in terms that we can understand, relate to, psychological terms, if you will, and I'm trying to relate this back to the idea that they were a little too casual, that this was kind of a payback for the time when even the elders were a little too casual in the way they greeted the divine presence back at the time of the giving of the Torah. That what we're experiencing over here, and this is something which we have to experience every single day. You know, we are created, put on this earth, and endowed with tremendous, tremendous faculties and abilities. You know, a mind, a soul, emotions, we're you know, like the sages say, a child, a baby is like a king. You know, a person is born and he's like a king. Why is he like a king? Because he gets everything he wants. He's hungry. The baby's hungry. He cries. He gets food. No. This is the condition of life. We are put on this world. We're like a king. But the truth is, we're not really a king. Because we have a king. We have our Father in heaven, who is the provider of everything that we have. And really, he's the king. We're the subjects. Yet we can easily see ourselves as the king. And say, what's coming to me? And take all of the things that we have for granted. And instead of saying, like you said, instead of saying, what can I do for you, God, it becomes, what can you do for me? And this is, let's call it in contemporary terms, an ego thing. That every single day of our lives, we have to confront our ego vis-a-vis God. And you can almost boil all of life's decisions down to that on a certain level. And I know this is very, you know, philosophical and theoretical, and one has to learn how to incorporate the existence of God into his daily life. But on a very broad psychological level, we have to confront. We have to ask ourselves every day, Who's number one and who's number two? You know, is God number one and I'm number two, or am I number one? And we have to grapple with this issue every single day. And when God is number one, and when we're clear on that, it's a beautiful world. There's nothing, there's no problems. The sun is bright. Even when it's cloudy, it's bright. Any problem that comes up, it's not a problem. I'm so blessed. I have so much to be thankful for. I don't even deserve half of the things I have. And it's a totally it's a bright world. Turn it around and put the I before God, and it's a terrible world. Oy vey, look what I'm missing. The food's not good. I don't know where we're going. How come I'm in the wilderness? How come I don't have this? How come everything is so terrible? Who's first? Me or God? And I think, you know, it can be manifest in so many small different ways. You know, when the elders were at Mount Sinai, was there a real strong reverence, or was there a casualness? When it was time to leave Mount Sinai, is there a sense of how can we leave God, you know, the mountain, even if we have to leave, but we're gonna leave, hesitatingly, rather than eagerly.
You can't look at it as leaving God because that's the cloud.
No, I know, but if we're leaving because we don't want to get any more commandments,
yeah,
that's putting me first. That's saying I don't want to do all that. Sure, but what's in the attitude? And also we can understand why Moshe had such a difficult time once the people have the attitude of what's God doing for me. You know, a leader, however inspired and however great he is, cannot lead if there's no followers. If the people don't want to be led, if people don't want to be inspired, you can't be a leader. And Moshe Rabbeinu was right. And somehow this ego, or this, we say in Yiddish, the zich, the self coming out, he had never encountered before in the Jewish people. Somehow until now they were still mesmerized, they were still under some type of a spell, or they were just so inundated by their suffering from Egypt that they were just at God's feet. But all of a sudden they start to get their oats and they start to feel the zich coming out, and all of a sudden, where are you taking us? Where's the food? We're not happy. This isn't good. That isn't good. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, these people are putting themselves first. I can't possibly lead them. And Hashem says, you're right. You can't lead a people like this. You're going to have a system of judges, and you have to have division of responsibility and so forth. And it just, but this was, this the, this started to unfold, and this was at the core of all of the decline that takes place, you know, with the spies having the gall to come back and saying, God's taking us to a place and there are giants there and they're going to destroy us. All of a sudden here we are, you know, like we know everything, and we're judging God instead of listening to him. And unraveled. That's an interesting question. According to, I thought about that. I said, is this something new, or did they already experience this at the golden calf? And you know, based on, I would have said yes, except based on what we studied and what I studied in that episode. What I learned from there, I don't know if anybody was here, you can listen to the CD, if anybody was, the root of the sin was the way they perceived God. They did not want to replace God. They just wanted, the way that Rabbi Dessler explained it, is that they wanted to perceive God behind, in a little bit more in nature, in a hidden way, rather than a revealed way. It was never to the point where they had anything rebellious to say about God. It was an error. It was an error in the way they perceived God, but it never came to the point where they were judging God, or they were putting themselves or their interests before God's interests. That had never occurred. It was bad. But Moshe didn't say, and Moshe didn't say, how can I lead these people? In fact, Hashem said to Moshe, let me destroy them and make a new nation for you. And Moshe said, no way, over my dead body. I go where they go. You never heard him talk this way. And how can I lead them? So I think there's a basic difference. In the case of the incident of the golden calf, God was still first. And here that was on the line, the ego.
So I understood the golden calf, though it was inspired mostly by the proselytes. Is that right?
Well, the proselytes. Yeah.
And they were really all killed, mostly. And so it could have been the different people involved. And now these are the Israelites.
Well, actually, the complaining of the food was the rabble, and the rabble were actually these people that came along. I don't know, I guess they didn't all die at the time of the calf, and these are the ones that are starting. And it's true, they were kind of egging them on, but the people would not have followed them. It says here, that it says that the rabble that was among them cultivated a craving, and the children of Israel also wept. You know, they followed. So there was a weakness in the Jewish people. Anyway, I don't know how, again, you know, I don't have a particular source that says this, but it sounds to me, from what we're reading, that this is the human, you know, the human condition of the ego. And where am I and where is God? Top. And it just makes all the difference in the world. And has, you know, has repercussions all the way down the line. So that's something that if we want to try to contemplate something and see where we can check ourselves and where we can look for an approach to just to creating, you know, positive thinking amongst Jews. And in our, you know, religious lives, this would seem to me an area of a concentration and thinking in our own experiences where we can put God first and where we can really see that we are beneficiaries, and everything that we have in life is a gift from God, and we should be nothing but thankful rather than being on the other side, that we're looking down and taking inventory. And hopefully this is something that people can find inspiring. Okay. Hopefully that's